last week we finished the third cycle of sin, judgment, and restoration, right? And this week we've entered our fourth cycle. Now, the sin and judgment, as you all know, is not orderly in your reading, right? It's not orderly for those of us who are very literal and we're like, what are the sins? Okay, what are the judgments? It's like all mixed in there. Oh, okay, now we're reading sin and now we're reading judgment. But what I want to affirm for you is if you're seeing this cycle, then that's good. That's what we want. If you're seeing the cycle, then the details of it that you're missing or that you're like, I don't really understand that, that's okay. You know, you're not going to understand every single detail that's in there. And that's what the small group time and the teaching time is for as well. How many are part of the current LifePoint series now on Galatians, just coming on Sunday mornings? And you're catching that. Okay, has anybody noticed that continual reference to Abraham and the Mosaic covenant? All right, this is not a coincidence that we're studying Hosea at the same time, because the Bible is one story, right? It's one story. There's a connection within, and it's one story. It's a love letter. It's a love letter. It's not a rule book. It's a love letter for us. And our prayer as a teaching team is that you're seeing that you're seeing the connection everywhere. What I want to do is I want to go over your map in Appendix E, and you don't have to pull it up because I'm going to show it to you here, because I want to make sure that everybody is understanding the terminology when we're referring to Israel and Judah. So Israel and Judah began as one nation, okay? It was one nation called Israel under Abraham, and Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac was the father of Jacob. And Jacob had 12 sons. And one of those sons you might have heard of, his name is Joseph. So a lot of people know his story. The Lord renamed Jacob to Israel. He gave him that name. He said, from now on, you will be Israel. And that's where we get the name Israel. And so all the descendants then of Jacob are Israelites, okay? So all the people who have come from that time are Israelites. One nation, okay? I'm going back in time. We're at one nation, Israel and Israelites, okay? And the reference to Israel originally was a person. All right, so here's our map. So Jacob, or Israel, had 12 sons. And his sons are actually, when the land was given out after the Exodus from Egypt, it was given out to the 12 tribes of Jacob, with two exceptions. First, the tribe of Levi was the tribe of priests. And so the priests were not going to get an allotment of land. They were going to have land in each of the territories because all of the territories needed to have priests in them. So they were the one that everyone was going to support in their own. So they don't have their own allotment here. The second exception is that Joseph's sons, you won't see Joseph on here. So the yellow highlights are the tribes, the 12 sons of Jacob. Okay, and I did make a note on here, yes, that the 12 tribes are listed in Genesis 35, 23 to 26, if you want to go back and check that for yourselves. But you won't see Joseph on here either. And the reason is because instead of Joseph being given an allotment, his two sons were, right? So it was actually a double blessing for him to get, you know, his two sons and get two areas. So we've pulled Levi out. He doesn't get his own territory, but we've added an extra son for Joseph. So we have 12. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I had to add Dan on there. So Dan wasn't on there if you want to add that. 10, 11, 12. Okay? One nation called Israel. This was the time after the Exodus when the people were settled. This was one nation, okay? And you can read all about the 12 tribes and Jacob, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the book of Genesis in the Bible. So where does Judah come from? Where does the nation of Judah come from? Okay, well, it wasn't a friendly split when the kingdom split. But in the time of the kings, you know, the first king was Saul, the second king was David, and most of us have heard of David, the famous David, and then after him was Solomon, and after that was the split of the kingdoms. And you guys have that in your timeline. You show that, you show where that split comes, right? Okay, so now we have this split of the two kingdoms, but again, it's still the same land, right? And it's still the same Israelites. So the people of Judah are Israelites. The people of Israel are Israelites. The capital of Israel before the split was Jerusalem, right? The city of Jerusalem, the city of David. And so when the split happened, the king of Israel was like, well, my people aren't going down to their capital to go worship God. We're going to build our own places of worship. And so that's what we read about in Dan and Bethel. We read about those places of worship that were created because they didn't want disloyalty and the people going down to Jerusalem. And that is then where Samaria becomes the capital of Israel, okay? Because Jerusalem is in the southern kingdom of Judah, and Samaria now is going to become the capital. That's where the king of Israel is going to have his place, okay? Last thing was the name Ephraim, okay? We've been reading Ephraim, and we've been seeing that used synonymously or interchangeably with Israel. And the only thing I can liken that to is kind of like, you know, you can call me Mrs. DiDio, or you can call me Amy, or you can call me Ames, or whatever. You know, we can get really friendly. And Ephraim is just like a way of saying, you know, you're my Ephraim, you're my guy. You know, Israel's this big place, and Ephraim is just a little more intimate. There's more to that. I'm not an expert on that. I just want to make sure you all understand when you see Ephraim, it's Israel. So I don't want you to be confused. Why is it Ephraim? Why is it pick that one? You can go study that. I haven't studied it. Okay. All right. So hopefully that clears up some understanding with that. All right. So we are going to open this week's study. We've opened it with a lamenting question from God in chapter 6, verse 4. What can I do with you, Ephraim? What can I do with you, Judah? The Israelites are steeped in sin. And so far in the previous chapters, we've seen the breaking of covenant, the Mosaic covenant, idolatry, social, political, spiritual corruption, including among the leadership of the priests, leaders, and rulers, and a turning to help for help to Assyria, who we know Assyria is going to turn on them, right? God is asking a question. What can I do with you, Ephraim? What can I do with you, Judah? And he's considering these sins, and he laments that their love is like a morning mist. It's like early dew that disappears. That's no love at all. He desires mercy. It's an inward condition, not sacrifice, outward. Acknowledgement, being known, rather than burnt offerings. Their sacrifices are offensive to him because it doesn't come from a heart of love and obedience for God's word. And Micah 6:8 reminds us of God's desire for his people to act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with their God. Now, there's a repeat of the charges now in this week's lesson, along with some new ones. So I want you to follow along with me, starting with day one. In 6:7, it mentions what charges, and I just want you to holler them out. And we've kind of gone over some of these in our groups. What charges are we talking about in 6:7? Broken covenant, unfaithfulness. In verse 8, footprints of blood implies murder, right? And also, in verse 9, we're hearing about murder as well. By whom, in verse 9? The priests. Now, calling it murder could also be a way of describing perverse behavior of those who should have been closest to God. And wicked schemes in verse 9 is actually translated from the Hebrew zima, and that refers to the vilest sexual sins elsewhere in the Bible. And I looked them up, and I ain't reading them. 7:1 on day 2 mentions what crimes? What crimes do we have there? Just holler them out. Deceit. What was it? Thievery. Yes. And verse 3, they delight the king with wickedness. What else? Lies. Okay, and so verses 4 and 5, the Israelites as a whole were adulterers physically and spiritually. Their passion for wickedness was like fire in a baker's oven, very hot and constantly burning. When the leaders add a little drunkenness to this passion for wickedness, what's your result? In verse 6, their hearts are like an oven. If you turn back to 5:4, which is last week, what does it say is in their hearts in 5:4? What of prostitution? A spirit of prostitution is in their hearts, okay? Far from the heart that God desires. In verse 7, They devour their rulers, all their kings fall. That's describing the assassination of one or more of Israel's kings. It's an example of this passion for wickedness that we've been mentioning. And Hosea saw these assassinations happen four times. So I'm going to turn to Appendix B. You're going to love my Appendix B. You're going to want a copy of it because I took a lot of notes here. I'm very proud of my Appendix B, right? but anyway, you know, this just makes it really easy for you. And so I want to show you, you know, what you have here in your book, okay? We're talking about these assassinations. You see with Shallum, he killed Zechariah. Okay, so he killed this guy, and then Menahem, he kills Shallum. So if you want to just highlight that in your book to just kind of remember, wait, who killed who? Who was a killer? Who wasn't a killer? Just mark it like I did. And then we have down here, Pekah killed Pekahiah, and Hoshea killed Pekah. And so in four times in Hosea's ministry time, is he seeing these. So it's like every revolutionary state that has no faith in anything beyond itself, Israel is burning up in its greed for power. Back to 7, 8 through 11, the list of offenses continues, with Israel now calling on Assyria and turning to Egypt like a deceived and senseless dove. In other words, they're not using reason or logic as foreigners blatantly take advantage of them. And 8, 5 through 6 is describing Israel's capital, Samaria, at the height of idol worship. Now let's look at what God desires of them and pay attention to the emotions behind it. So we're going to go back now to chapter 7, verse 7. And he says, "None of them calls on me." Do you hear God's suffering at being rejected, ignored, and forgotten? And look at 7:10. Even if they don't return to God, they could at least what? You holler that out. Search for him, right? In verse 13, God longs to redeem them. In verse 16, oh no, verse 14, they do not from there. Verse 16, they do not turn to the Most High. Why does he refer to himself there as the Most High? And look at 8:14. How does God refer to himself in 8:14? I heard their maker. He's the Most High, and he's their maker. The maker of what? The maker of heaven and earth? The maker of people? The maker of life, right? I'm the Most High. God is not having an identity crisis. He's not worried about who he is. He knows what he wants. He knows who he is. Can you picture God suffering? This being that can root armies and send fire and plagues, fight like a lion. Can you picture him in anguish for his people? He's like a spurned lover. His longing is heartbreaking. The ungratefulness and rebellion is devastating. And Hosea understands it all because he's living it. He can identify with the emotions of God and his anger and love for people. Can you better understand the reasons for the judgments that we've seen and seeing God more as faithful and just and patient and compassionate and merciful and abounding in love as opposed to harsh and angry? Now, we've been talking about the threat of exile for Israel and Judah. We know it's coming because we've looked ahead, right? But at this point in the study, even though Hosea is not presenting from the point of view of chronology, we can definitely summarize that a partial exile has occurred based on some text references. And while we don't know the specific chronology, it doesn't keep us from understanding the message of a God who would do anything to bring people into relationship with himself. But why is exile the ultimate consequence for sin? What is the significance of exile? So I have a question for you. Has anyone here, and you don't have to raise your hand, has anyone here ever moved across state lines? Have you left the familiar to start over, even if it's for a good reason? Have you ever been forced out without a choice, either through your own fault or the fault of another? Depending on your circumstances, it would take time to find your place and feel like you belong and fit in. It would be uncomfortable, unsettling, uncertain, and lonely for a while. I wonder if that's a touch of what exile would feel like. So I want to take you back to a time in history of Israel and Judah when they were one nation. And it was a real time for all the Israelites that they knew about, because it was before the law, before the covenant with Moses, before the Israelites were a people group. Now, some things don't get passed down in the family line, but this did, because it was their heritage and they were proud of it. And it begins with Abraham. He was 75 when the Lord first spoke to him. And the Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." What does the land represent? It's yours, right? I'm giving you land. It's yours. And there's a difference between renting and owning, right? When it's yours. No one tells you what you have to do with it. It allows for provision. You can grow your own crops. You can raise your own herds. It's protection. You can put a building on there. You can put doors to limit who's coming in and who's going out. You can put it, it's a shelter for you from the elements. Now, Abraham didn't get his land so easily or quickly because this promise was for his descendants. And sometime later, God spoke again to Abraham. And he said to him, "I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to take possession of it." But Abraham said, "Sovereign Lord, how can I know that I will gain possession of it?" And the Lord said to him, "Know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and mistreated there. But I will punish the nation that they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions. You, however, Abraham, will go to your ancestors in peace and be buried at a good old age. In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure." When the sun had set and darkness had fallen, a smoking firepot with a blazing torch appeared and passed between the pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram and said, "To your descendants I give this land, from the Wadi of Egypt to the great river, the Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, Kenizzites, Kadmonites, Hittites, Perizzites, Rephaites, Amorites, Canaanites, Girgashites, and Jebusites." The Lord ratified, when you hear about that fire pot passing in between, that is the Lord ratifying his covenant, promising land to Abraham. And what kind of covenant was this? Was it a conditional covenant or an unconditional covenant? It was an unconditional covenant. Covenant, no conditions. This is my promise to you. You have to do nothing. Now, it sounds like a good deal, but did anybody catch that part about the mistreatment and the slavery for 400 years? I'm not reading that thinking, ooh, yay, and I would not want that for my children. Why can't we just like get to the good stuff? And it's not a judgment on the Israelites here, is it? Because in verse 14, he says, "But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves." It's interesting. But Abraham seemed okay with it. After all, the Lord of heaven had spoken directly to him. Now, we know if we keep reading then exactly what happens. What nation was that enslaved them? Egypt. The descendants of Abraham became dependent on Egypt during a 7-year famine at the time of Joseph, Jacob's son. The food was not scarce in Egypt during the famine, thanks to Pharaoh's dream years earlier that Joseph was able to interpret, and he helped Egypt plan for. Thank God for speaking through Joseph and helping him prepare Egypt, right? You can read all about that in Genesis. Unfortunately, when all the trade goods ran out, all the Israelites had left to barter with Egypt was themselves. So they sold themselves in exchange for food. And here's what happened next in resourceful Egypt. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died, but the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly, increased in numbers, and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. Then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt. "Look," he said to his people, "the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, will join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country." So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with harsh labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their harsh labor, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. So the Israelites grew in number and multiplied in Egypt, where they became a large people group. Have you ever been in a situation at work where maybe your boss's style is kind of oppressive, or like you're with family or friends and somebody's causing some division? And it brings you together, doesn't it? You kind of unite on this front of this common cause. Even if you can't change the situation, you've got something in common. And Egypt was where the place that the Israelites saw themselves as a people group. They united primarily by oppression and slavery, but they were all in the same boat. What was slavery in Egypt like? As a parent, what would be your hope for your children? What did they own? Did they own land? What did they live for? What did they look forward to for themselves and for their children? What did they desire? Freedom, right? Freedom. A life of bondage is living at a minimum. It's existence, but it's not living. Was there any hope that they had for freedom after hundreds of years of slavery? What did Egypt represent for the Israelites? Slavery, bondage, oppression. Now, I forgot to mention that the Israelites are also united by their connection to Abraham and their connection to the God of Abraham. And as we read earlier, they still shared the identity of being children of the promise, even while serving an oppressive taskmaster. What was the hope for freedom? Enter God. During that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. And God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. And then God appears to Moses in a burning bush, and he says, "I'm the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And at this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. But the Lord said, "I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites." Sound familiar? "And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." Out of Egypt. Out of Egypt. Away. No more slavery. The Israelites as a people witnessed 10 plagues on Egypt before they were permitted to leave. They plundered Egypt. The Exodus, or exit from Egypt, you can read about in the book of Exodus, which is the second book of the Bible. And that Exodus represents their leaving behind of slavery and moving toward freedom. Finally, after hundreds of years, the Lord is leading his people and they're going where he leads. He gives them the law as a means to govern themselves under his authority. After all, how do you go from being in slavery from 400 years to self-governing? And Diana touched on that last week. She talked about the chaos of coming out of slavery and all these people. But God's going to help, right? And God then reminds them, too, of the promise to Abraham of land. They would be a people group now with their own land. And our map in Appendix E that we showed you, it shows how the land was eventually assigned. It's a happy ending, right? What did God require of them in exchange for their freedom? We gave them the Mosaic Covenant, right? And what kind of covenant was the Mosaic Covenant? Conditional or unconditional? It was conditional. It had conditions to it. You are required to do this, and I will do this. Deuteronomy chapter 28 through 30. Get that in your head. All right, so the history lesson is over. We're done our flashback, and now we're fast forwarding back up now to the time of Hosea. What did Egypt represent for the Israelites? All the Israelites. What did Egypt represent? Oh, was there anything good about their time in Egypt? Why are they running to Assyria? Are they that foolish? Isn't Assyria like the Egypt that they came from? You, Assyria, you have what we need. Really? What are the characteristics of Assyria that are attractive? What's the lure? Power? Protection? Does Assyria require anything in exchange for protection? Can you really be free when you're indebted to another? Do they not remember their history in Egypt? Are they going to do this again, a repeat of Egypt? Are they that gullible? And are we any different? What are ways that we return to bondage instead of turning to God? Why do we do that? All right, so I had asked you earlier, why was exile the ultimate consequence for sin? And what's the significance of exile? So we see Israel, the people and the land now, in the time of Hosea, crumbling and dwindling as they move further from God. He's reaching toward them, and they have all forgotten him. God is not chastising in revenge, but out of necessity in his government of the world and in his requirements for his people. Exile is the ultimate consequence because it's a stripping away. Although we know it's temporarily, a stripping away of the promise to Abraham. No more land. Exile means being forced out and given over to the authority of another kingdom. Being enslaved, oppressed, no longer respected or feared as a people group. It's abandonment, rejection. It's not belonging. We talked earlier about moving and what that feels like, but the difference here is they're moving out and away from freedom, not toward anything hopeful, because all that they're going to have is what they're going to carry on their backs. So we opened this week's study with a question from God in 6:4. What can I do with you, Ephraim? What can I do with you, Judah? God in his lament has sent his prophets to warn, and now he is choosing exile. What are his options? You know, the Bible starts with the book of Genesis. It's the very beginning. And God creating the world and people. From the beginning, God wanted a relationship with people. And by Genesis 3, really early on, the people have already given in to unbelief and distrust of God and sinned. We call that the fall. We read three chapters later in Genesis 6. The Lord saw how great, chapter 6, I'm just letting you know, like I'm barely into the book, okay, chapter 6. The Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth. Sound familiar? And that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. And the Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. So the Lord said, I will wipe away from the face of the earth the human race I've created, and with them the animals, the birds and the creatures that move along the ground, for I regret that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked faithfully with God. Well, that'll get rid of all the bad people, right? But God did say never again in Genesis chapter 6. So hold on. If all the bad people were destroyed, where did all the wickedness come from among the Israelites? All Noah's descendants weren't good? Did some of them go to the dark side? What does this teach us about where sin comes from? It doesn't come from others or circumstances. It comes from within. And the story of Noah is the example to us of how not to remove evil from the world. It doesn't work. Humanity has a sin problem. To the Jews who had believed him, Jesus said, "If you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." And they answered him, "We are Abraham's descendants and have never been slaves of anyone. How can you say that we shall be set free?" Are they for serious? How can they remember their heritage with Abraham and not remember their heritage with Moses. We have a sin problem. We have a sin problem. You cannot remove evil from the hearts of people so easily. And God knew this, and we know from Galatians on Sundays that the law doesn't work either. We need another way. And Jesus replied, same conversation. Very truly, I tell you, everyone who sins is a slave to sin. Now, a slave has no permanent place in the family, but a son belongs to it forever. So if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. It all points to Jesus. He can set us free. He's the remedy for the sin problem. This is one of my favorite passages because it really explains the entire purpose of what Jesus did. For God, who loves us and loves people because he made people to love, in all his fullness was pleased to live in Christ, and through him God reconciled everything to himself. He made peace with everything in heaven on earth by means of Christ's blood on the cross. This includes you. You were his enemies, separated from him by your evil thoughts and actions. Yet now he has reconciled you to himself through the death of Christ in his physical body. As a result, he has brought you into his own presence, and you are holy and blameless as you stand before him without a single fault. Isn't it so great, this new covenant? What kind of covenant is this? Conditional or unconditional? It's unconditional. Christ gave all to deliver us back from the slavery of sin so that we can enter into this intimate relationship with the Most High, our Maker. Hosea 2:16 says, "In that day, you will call me my husband. You will no longer call me my master because you are not slaves any longer." Why would the people go back to Egypt? Why do we go back to Egypt? I have some questions up here that you guys can use in your small groups if you like. Can you admit your sin problem? It's the first step toward freedom in Christ. And what are you living for? What are you searching for? What are you settling for? The Lord wants it to be a who, not a what. Are you enjoying all the heart satisfaction of your relationship with Jesus in love? If not, what's keeping you from that? And do you, like Hosea, see God's sorrow as a means of entering into God's heart and revealing him to others?